Welcome to the SMA edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the spinal muscular atrophy community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're here at MDA's 2025 Clinical and Scientific Conference in Dallas, and today's guest is Liza Weissman, who has spinal muscular atrophy type 2. Liza was diagnosed with SMA at 13 months of age and was born and raised in Colorado. She's currently a law student at William & Mary Law School in Williamsburg, Virginia. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
In your presentation today, the focus was not so much on therapies and treatments and potential cures for the disease, but more like about what it's like to live with SMA on a day-to-day basis. How would you summarize this?
Yeah, so I'm 22 years old, and on a daily basis, I struggle with the little things. And the little things is what makes a person's life, whether they realize it or not, from getting up in the morning to being able to brush your own teeth, to wiping your butt when you go to the bathroom, to going to school and being able to take notes by yourself or getting to school. And so for me, I struggle with these things, and I have to plan out my day in a way where I can be as independent as my disease allows. And my caregivers play a massive role in that, but it doesn't make the challenges or the exhaustion or the effort of it all any easier.
So when you were diagnosed at 13 months of age, I mean, that it took a while for your parents to realize that there was something wrong with you.
Kind of, yeah. So my mom kind of nicknamed me Lazy Liza when I was in the womb because I just didn't move. I didn't kick. I didn't do anything. And once I was born, I hated the Johnny jump up or anything that would require me to do anything physical. She could set me on the edge of a counter and I would just stay there. And then my sister, who's about 2 years older than me, she also kind of realized something was up, even though she was so young. She wouldn't play with me. She was super delicate and whatnot and just didn't have that contact or like that rough play that you typically would see in a little kid. And my mom then took me to the doctor, and the doctor was like, okay, I see why this is interesting. The problem is, right, I lived in the deep mountains in a very, very small town with a K-12 school with less than 500 kids. There was not much around, but I got lucky. Because right where I was at that weekend was a traveling neurologist. And I got in to see that neurologist, who then looked at my mom and said, get her in to Children's Hospital as soon as you possibly can. And my mom did that. And she was able to get my diagnosis a few months later, officially diagnosed on June 13th, 2003. So I was officially diagnosed on Friday, June 13th, 2023. 2003.
Now, you mentioned during your presentation about difficulty even going to school, having a social life with other kids your age, etc.
Yeah. I never got along with people my age, to be honest. And I always say, like, I was raised in a doctor's office. I was raised going to one thing or the other, and I was always traveling for an appointment, and getting anywhere, playing outside wasn't an option, especially where I was at. There was so much snow that in the winter, I just did not, like, I would go to school and I went to the public school, but I just never had that connection. And even as I got older, it was just never there. I didn't get along with people my age. Maybe it was because of the challenges that I had to face. They made me grow up faster or something. And now, you know, in law school, I'm for the first time in my life, which as sad as this is, I have a group of friends and it's really cool and I enjoy it and it's fun. And like, I realize what it means to just be able to see someone eating lunch and be like, hey, what's going on? And I enjoy that and I have fun with that. But it's still hard because they can text and be like, we're going here. And it's like, I can't go there. And even like, my law school will do a bar crawl every once in a while, like once each semester. And 3 out of 4 of the bars, or the majority of the bars, aren't accessible. I can't get into them. I can only go to one in the list. So it's like, okay, why am I going? So this time I was like, all right, why don't you guys come over to my place? We'll do a pregame and then you'll head off and go do that. And it was fun and it was good. And I had a good time with that pregame, and that's all I needed. I honestly couldn't care less if I go to a bar crawl or not. It's not my scene, but it's still the fact that like I couldn't. And you'll find those things everywhere, whether it's like we're going to this restaurant or we're going to this thing in DC because this person's talking. And I just am like, the logistics for me to go over and spend one night in a hotel are not worth it.
You mentioned during your talk that little things, for example, that cause difficulty for you, but most people people would take for granted. You mentioned, for example, that when you eat, you're always looking for a surface so that you can rest your arm without tremors and without basically dropping food all over yourself.
Yeah, that's honestly a more recent development for me. And it's really kind of scary to realize how weak I'm getting, that like for me to be able to eat, the chances of it falling on me if my arms are just at my armrest level is very high, and I make a mess, and that's not a good look. And so at home, they have like counters, tops, like I can drive under, and I find myself propping my arm up on the countertop while my food stays on my tray just to be able to eat, because it raises my arm to my mouth level so I don't have to worry about that distance. And it does make it so much easier, but it's also extremely inconvenient because that's not an option when you go out to a restaurant.
And you weren't doing that before.
I was not doing that before. That's honestly a development in the last few months that I've really actually noticed that is something I'm doing. Like I'm wanting to eat at a counter, not at the table.
So you started on Spinraza.
I started on Spinraza years ago. And now I'm on Evrysdi. I started on Spinraza when I was a sophomore in high school.
So prior to that, you weren't taking anything?
Prior to that, I took sodium phenylbutyrate. So that was a trial drug that was developed years ago, originally created for urea cycle disorders, oddly enough. And that is the drug that changed my life, like more than the others in every single way. When I was diagnosed as a very, very weak type 2. When you look at me now, I'm stronger than some type 3s my age, even though I've never taken a single independent step in my life. When I got on that med, literally on my second birthday, I gained strength rapidly, and I was able to keep it for a very, very long time until Spinraza came along, at which point I switched.
And what was your experience like with Spinraza?
My experience with Spinraza was a rough one. So by that point, I had already had a variety of surgeries, especially for scoliosis. I've had 14 back surgeries now in total. I struggled. So they first had to do a laminectomy to take out a part of my spine so that they could get the needle to my spinal cord. And I had a dura tear with that. About 6 weeks following that, I then got Spinraza. They went in, they gave me the shot. I had a spinal fluid leak that put me on bed rest for a month. I missed a month of school on bed rest, laying flat in the dark, absolutely miserable on way too many meds for a month. And then months later, we tried again, and I tried to get Spinraza again. And every single time I had a small spinal fluid leak that lasted a few days. And the truth is, like, it was scary. Like, why am I choosing to put myself through getting a drug when I've already paid the cost for that drug and I could pay it again? And the reality is I was losing strength so fast, and it was like, how long am I going to be able to eat? How long am I going to be able to hold my head up? How long am I going to be able to sit independently? And so that was the question I asked. And the reality was, it was worth it to go through the risk. And I did that for a while. I then had more problems with it. And eventually they found a different way of giving it to me. I have fairly permanent, it's still there, pooling of spinal fluid in my back to this day from a lot of issues. They don't actually know if I got a lot of my Spinraza doses, because it took about 6 of them before they realized that there was spinal fluid pooling randomly in the middle of my back.
So Spinraza, in effect, hasn't really done much for you?
I don't know. I don't know if I got it. I mean, I know I kind of stabilized, but I wasn't, like, it was so touch and go. Like, I'm not sure. Like, I know I wasn't losing crazy, but I also wasn't gaining. And then when I got on Evrysdi, it was an entirely different story. I started gaining strength rapidly. I started being able to do things that I had never done in my life. For the first time, I got on like hands and knees, my hands like as in my elbow, not like full straight arm hands. And I had never done that like ever before. My favorite thing, well, two favorite things, is I was able to cook by myself, and I still can. I'm holding on to that one for as long as I humanly possibly can. I love to cook. I'm Italian, comes with the territory. And then the second thing is just lifting. Like, my dad has these beautiful like glasses, crystal glasses. And I like to be able to lift those without a straw. Like, I'm one of those like old school, not like when I have a drink, I want it in a nice glass.
And now you can do that.
For now. Yes. For now.
You mentioned kind of several incidents that happened with caregivers in your talk. And one of the things you mentioned was the time that you spent 3 hours in a shower while the caregiver was out drunk.
Oh, that was fun. What a great night, you know? I was lucky, if you think about it. I was in a college dorm shower, so I had hot water the whole time. So that's a perk.
But the water was running.
Yeah, the water was running. I was in the dark because the fan in that bathroom was horrendously loud that we chose to leave it off. And I had just gotten in. She walked out to grab something. And I was like, you good? Like, I'm ready. Like, let's get this done and go to bed. It's already midnight. It was very late on July 4th of all nights. She was like, yeah, I'll be there in a second. And I think she sat down and blacked out. And I was screaming at the top of my lungs for 3 hours with absolutely no one around because no one was around. And she did not wake up for that long until finally she woke up and came in.
Okay, so she didn't last long as your caregiver after that.
Oh, yeah. Well, she never understood quite what she did wrong. That was, I think, the biggest problem.
You mentioned a few other things, but just to summarize, where you talked about patients, you know, in general having improvements, and then there's a plateau, and then things start getting more difficult. And then the presentation that we saw was what the top self-reported needs for SMA patients are. And the number one is not only gaining, but keeping your muscle strength. That's an issue.
That's a very big issue. Yes. I mean, right, when I was diagnosed, like, it was how long are you going to live? And then once you figured out, okay, yes, you're going to live, it's like, what is that life going to be like? And the truth is, it's a very hard one, depending on what you have. And everything's dependent on the muscle. Can you breathe by yourself? Can you eat by yourself? And losing that strength is a very real thing. For me, like, yeah, I had some incredible grit gains when I got on Everisd. And like I said, I'm holding on to them for as long as I can, but I'm now putting a straw in my wine glass. So that's not it. I am losing strength.
What about breathing?
Breathing is a bit scary for me. I can breathe, but if I want to take a full breath, I need to pay attention. And I actually have to be intentional in taking that full breath during the day. I do breathe with a BiPAP at night, and that's good and that's helpful. And I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, I need that. That's great. I didn't realize how much I needed it until I was on a long train ride one day and fell asleep at night for about like 5-6 hours. And when I woke up, I felt like I had pneumonia and I was like coughing up all the goop and stuff. And I was like, oh my goodness, did I get myself pneumonia in 6 hours because I decided to sleep without a BiPAP? And then I couldn't let myself go back to sleep because I was terrified.
Are the people around you, are they generally understanding of your situation or no, or they're just not interested?
It depends. It depends on, you know, the day. And if I have my service dog with me, people I think are much more welcoming and open to like coming up and asking questions. And I want people to ask questions. I want them to come up to me and ask and to learn, because that's the only thing that's going to change anything. And so I'm big about that. But on a daily basis, you have to ask for help. People aren't just going to notice it. People are oblivious. People are in their own heads. And some are really clueless. Like, I've had someone the other day at Starbucks was like, I hope you get better soon. And I thought it was because I ordered a medicine ball because I like that kind of tea. But then he was like, I'm not sick. I like the tea. He was like, oh, okay. Well, I hope you get better soon. And I was like, huh? And like, you could tell he was referring to the fact I was in a chair. And I was like, that's weird.
Well, isn't that better than having somebody wanting to pray for you?
That is better than someone wanting to pray for me. That happens too, a lot. You'd be surprised. Sometimes it's really bad. And people come up and they, you know, put their hand on my head and, oh, God bless you. Let me pray for you. Longest one lasting over 5 minutes of someone, a kid younger than me, a teenager. And then his mom joined in halfway through in a nice long 5-minute prayer about how I hope God gets me to walk again one day. Well, I don't know about that, but something would be nice.
The kind of advocacy, the fact that you're here at the MDA conference on its 75th anniversary, what kind of message do you hope to send?
The community is a beautiful one, and it's a strong one. But I think the thing that we need now, more than ever, is powerful voices in the community and strength and resilience to keep growing and to keep changing the world around us. If you look at like 100 years ago, like what the stereotype for what it is to have a muscular dystrophy or a rare disease and to be in a wheelchair, the stereotype was you don't go out, you stay at home and you live in your parents' basement. And the sad part is that for a lot of people, that reality still exists for whatever reason, because they don't know how to be independent. They don't know how to go out. And I want to see a screaming from the rooftop. I want to see the community going out and living the life that they want to live. And I want to show the world that we can do whatever we want, but we're going to have to fight for it.
Well, on that note, we're out of time. Thank you very much. We've been talking to Liza Weissman, who has SMA and is a law student at William & Mary Law School in Williamsburg, Virginia. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.